I find my bag and unzip the pockets. It's awkward because my left hand's bundled up in a sort of mitten. But soon I can push my right-hand fingers into the creases of fabric. Each one seems to be full of tissues, twisted like the limbs of trees, and fraying into dust at the edges. How are the carers supposed to get in if we take the key safe away? And that's your old bag, Mum. What are you looking for? There won't be anything in there. She's right. The only bit of paper in here is an envelope. Addressed to Elizabeth. Did I say I would post it to her? I must have forgotten. I hope it wasn't anything important. I turn it over, trying to remember. There is a note taped to it. From Elizabeth's house. And underneath. Where is Elizabeth? Where is Elizabeth? I look at the envelope sadly. I suppose I should send it on. But where to? I'm craving apples as I push my finger into the corner of the envelope. The crisp paper tears at the crease, and soon it is past repair, so I may as well open the letter properly. I rip the envelope flap into scruffy shapes. There's just a slip inside, from the library. An overdue notice for a book. The library van has tried to collect it for the past few weeks. It is overdue by months, and the fine is more than £10. I feel funny about having opened it now. Post is property, and opening it is like breaking and entering. My postman father was always very definite about that, and he'd be furious if he could see me now. He nearly caught me opening a letter of Douglas's once. The address on that envelope to Mr. D. Weston was in Sukey's handwriting. That's what made me snatch it up from the kitchen table. Ma always left our post in a heap there, Douglas's along with ours. I never got anything, except occasionally a postcard from Uncle Trevor or a note from Audrey. But I liked to look through the pile anyway, trying to work out who the letters were from. Ma's sister Rose had pretty but messy handwriting, and Uncle Trevor's was very black, with deep marks in the paper. Audrey always left blotches between her words, and I could picture the sides of her hands stained with ink. I knew Sukey's writing, of course, though she didn't send us letters. It would have been a bit funny, seeing as she was only about 10 streets away. I think we got one when she was on her honeymoon, but that was the only time. The letter to Douglas came about a week after we last seen Sukey, about a week before my parents started to worry. I was surprised no one had noticed the writing. And when Douglas didn't pick it up on his way out to the pictures, a terrible curiosity overcame me. I was stewing apples for the morning, and I had to lay down the spoon to feel the envelope. It was just paper inside, folded once, I thought, perhaps twice. I held it to the light with one hand, stirring the apples with the other, but I couldn't see anything. The paper of the envelope was too patched with labels over labels to make it last longer. Paper is a weapon of war. Save every scrap. It was difficult to forget the warning, though there was no war anymore to need weapons for. I'd meant to drop it back on the table, but for some reason I turned to the pan and, without really deciding to, angled the letter into a wave of steam. The apples simmered away, giving out their fruity, spicy smell, and I kept still, watching the paper buckle slightly with the moisture. My face was damp from standing over the saucepan, and soon the hand holding the letter was too. The edge of the envelope flap started to come loose, and I helped it along with my little finger, and in a few minutes it was halfway undone. That was when Dad walked in. I hadn't heard his footsteps on the stairs, and in a panic I dropped the envelope into the saucepan and stirred. He opened the kitchen door to put something in the outside bin, and the cold air found my damp skin, making me shiver. Dad took Ma's shawl from a chair on his way back in and put it round my shoulders.
"Must be nearly done now," he said, tapping the handle of the pan.
I nodded stiffly, praying he wouldn't look in it. When he walked back up to the sitting room, I sagged against the stove in relief and then lifted the letter out with a spoon. It was a soggy mess, and there was no way I'd be able to draw it apart without tearing the paper. I pressed it between two sheets of newspaper and laid it on a shelf in one of the top warming ovens to dry, hoping that the ink hadn't blurred too much, hoping no one would notice the faint blue tinge to the stewed apples when we had them at breakfast the next day. Douglas got home as I was washing up the pan. Ma had come down to the kitchen to say good night, and she asked him how his evening had been. He was as vague as ever about the film he'd seen.
It was one of those with fancy costumes. It wasn't very good.
The Wicked Lady, was it? I said, turning with soapy hands to watch his face.
Yes, that was it.
That's not showing any more. He swung stiffly towards me, but his eyes didn't lift from his shoes.
That can't have been it, then. I must have got it wrong.
The hurt in his pose reminded me so much of the first time I'd met him, the blushing and embarrassment at his being caught out with the nicknames, that I felt a flood of guilt. Water dripped from my hands onto my slippers. Why was I always so cruel to him? I didn't think I meant to be. I almost told him about the letter then, but thought that admitting I'd been trying to read his post might not make him feel any better. Chapter 10. I hate this place, and hardly ever come here. I hate the smell of the books, musty and unclean, and I never borrow books myself. So often you open one and find it stinks of cigarette smoke or has the remains of someone's dinner smeared over the pages. Of course, I don't read now, so it hardly matters.
"Mum, please keep your voice down," Helen says. "You're the one who asked to come."
She edges away slightly, and I walk over to the desk, feeling in my pockets. I can't think why I'd have wanted to be taken here. I've got a slip from the library, but it's addressed to Elizabeth, not me. The man behind the desk sweeps his fringe from his eyes, and I feel panicked for a moment, by his expectation, by the thousands of books on their shelves. Even if I knew what I wanted, how could I ever find it?
"I'm looking for something," I say to the man. "I just can't recall, you know."
"A book?"
I say, "I suppose it must be." And he asks what sort of book it is. But I don't know. He asks if it's fiction. "Oh, no," I say. "It's a true story. Only no one will believe me."
His brow wrinkles, and he smooths his fringe over the lines.
"What's the story about?" he says. "Perhaps I will know it."
"It's about Elizabeth," I say.
"Elizabeth? Could that be the title?"
I watch as he taps at letters on his computer.
"There's something with that name in the crime section," he says,
and points me in the right direction. Helen is rummaging through some papers, so I go over to the shelves alone. There aren't so many books here as there used to be. A lot of space has been given over to computers. They look very bright and enticing, but I've tried a few times and I just don't think I'll learn now. This set of shelves has the word crime pasted over it, and there are lots of books with bones on the covers or dripping blood. Mostly they are black books with neon writing. Something about them feels oppressive, frightening, and I don't think I'd like to enter any of the worlds inside them. But I take one anyway and read the blurb. It's about a woman on the run from a serial killer. I put it back.
There are 4 books with cream covers next to it. Mysteries set in Russia.
I don't think I'm quite up to that. I have enough mystery in my life as it is.
Helen comes quietly over to look with me.
I can't be bothered with these, I say. She shushes me and looks round, but there's practically no one here. We used to press flowers in books, I say, Suki and I, when I was young. We always meant to make a picture, but never got round to it. And years later I found the dried and flattened celandines and forget-me-nots, violets and buttercups, stuck between the pages of my father's old set of Mrs. Radcliffe romances. We pressed grasses, too, and clover leaves.
And Helen, that last time she came to dinner, I remember, I gave her a comb, and she put it inside a hardback book and pressed the covers together until the comb inside crunched and all the delicate little amber teeth fell out. And she said, "It's beautiful, thank you, darling," and kissed me before she slipped out the door. And I had her lipstick on my forehead.
I think that's how it was. But Helen doesn't think so, and she doesn't want to argue about it here. And do I want a book? Otherwise we'll go.
There's nothing I want, so we start to walk out past the desk. The man there has strange bendable fingers. And he sweeps his fringe to the side as he looks at me.
His fingers, I think, are like a fringe themselves, like the peach fringe of a standard lamp. For a moment I expect to see bookcases and clocks and empty plant pots jumbled against the desk, but there is only a trolley of books. The Mysteries of Udolpho is waiting to go back onto a shelf. I pick it up, weigh it in my hands, and then, holding it by its hard covers, I shake it to see if anything falls out. The spine makes a creaking noise.
"Hey, hey,"
the man at the desk says. "What are you doing? You can't treat books like that."
"Sorry," I say, dropping it onto the trolley. "I was just checking." I leave it where it lies and walk out to the street. Helen walks with me.
"Are we going home?" I ask.
She doesn't answer, and I suppose this means we are, and she can't be bothered to tell me again. I squint at her, but I can't tell if she makes any gesture. The sun's in my eyes, and it's difficult to see. The shape of her is distorted by the light. Circles of her silhouette removed as if by a pastry cutter. She walks in front, getting further ahead, and I struggle to keep up, struggle to make out which way she's going. I shut one eye and keep the shadow of Helen ahead of me. I just need to concentrate on that and not worry about directions or people or cars or the sun. Just focus on the shadow. I mustn't let it get away. It might lead me to Suki. "Mom, wait!" I turn to look behind, and the light shines straight onto my daughter's face. How did she get here? And was she always so wrinkled? I can see where freckles melt into the lines around her mouth. "She's outdoors too much, and that's bad for the skin. It ages you." I can't think how old she is, though. I ought to know.
"Who are you following?" she says.
I think for a moment, trying to make sense of the words. "Douglas," I say.
"I was following Douglas."
It was his loping shadow falling across the bramble hedge that told me he'd come home early. And a moment later I heard the creak of the larder door and the scrape of a spoon on glass. I was up and dressing before his shadow fell again across the hedge, not wanting to miss the opportunity to follow him as he left the house. For weeks I'd lain ill in bed, going over everything in my mind, knowing he was up to something, what with searching Suki's suitcase
and calling to the mad woman in the park. Now food was going missing, and I was determined to find out why. I ran quietly in his wake, slinking along the wall like ribbon on a spool. Being out of bed was a shock, and my legs protested at the sudden exercise. The outside air was full of the sharp scent of freshly cut pines, and the low sun shone in my eyes, forcing me to walk against it as if it were a strong wind. I was used to the dimness of my curtained room, and the light felt like a blast of sand. Douglas was a dark blur some way ahead, and I focused on that rather than try to see where I was. He paused once to look at the wreck of his old house, but it was only when we turned onto Suki Street and blue shade washed over me that I could look about properly. Only then that I knew where we were going. I followed him up the lane by Frank's house, keeping close to the wall so as not to be too near the hawthorn hedge, always suspecting that the mad woman might be there leaning into it. At the turning to the yard, I stopped, sagging, hot and tired against the wall, and pressed the toe of my shoe into the flesh of a leaf which lay on the ground. The mark, so definitely my doing, gave me courage, and I moved one eye slowly to the very edge of the building, my cheek brushing the brickwork. The sun was again blinding at this angle, and so I crept out, mole-like, and praying that I wouldn't be seen. But the yard was empty, except for the same old van that was always there, and I went to rest against it, shifting my shoulder blades against its hot metal wall. I hadn't expected the answering shifting inside. It was like a foot dragged along a floor, and fear had propelled me halfway across the yard before the doors opened and Douglas stepped out. "What? In there?" I said, hardly coherent with the exhaustion of being out of bed after so many weeks of illness. "Maud?" Douglas said, trying to block my view into the van. "How did you—" My steps slid back across the cobbles, and I looked past him to see a mess of broken furniture, tea chests and dust sheets jumbled against the wooden supports. There was a smell like old hedge cuttings, and there were crumbs on the floor. "Someone lives in there," I said. Douglas ducked his head. "Who, Douglas? Who is it? Is it Suki?" I felt a rush of something through me. My heart seemed to beat up through my shoulders, my neck, as if it was trying to escape through my head. Douglas put a hand out, steadying me as I staggered. "No, no, Maud. It's not Suki." For a moment, I wasn't sure I believed him. I didn't want to believe him. "Tell me the truth," I said, jerking away from his hold. "I know Suki was in a van. The mad woman told me. She told me before I got ill."
"Did she? It was nonsense," he said.
"Ravings. It's she who's in the van. This is where she's been living." I shivered at the thought, seeing now the scattering of stripped hawthorn stalks and the bundle of packing blankets that she must have been using as bedding. I thought for a moment that I could smell licorice. There was a piece of cracked mirror wedged behind one of the upright slats. Did she look into that, I wondered? And if so, what did she see? I crawled into the van, wanting to look in the same bit of glass, and saw Douglas's hand framed by the mirror, a crinkled package of newspaper visible between his fingers. "What's that?" I said, whirling round, reminded of the reason I'd been following him.
"You've been feeding her. You've been feeding the mad woman."
He looked for a moment like he might deny it. "Mars noticed the food going missing," I said, and he grimaced.
"Why? Why are you giving her our rations?"
"She's been living here a while, perhaps before Frank went to London, before Suki disappeared,"
I think it's possible she saw something.
Saw what?
What happened to Suki? Or where she went? Sometimes I think she's trying to tell me. The smell of the mangled leaves and stalks was sickening in the heat, and I began to shift towards the doors.
You mean you talk to her? You have conversations?
I thought he must be nearly as mad as the mad woman. Don't look like that. She's not an animal. She can speak.
I know, I said, though it seems so strange to be talking about her, to be allowed to actually talk about her. It was like discussing an animal, but a mythical one, perhaps, a griffin or a unicorn. I know, only she usually shouts about watching people and smashed glass and vans and summer squash and flying birds.
And about Suki?
I stopped in my outward scramble. Once, perhaps. I thought she said Suki's name once. What does that matter?
He didn't answer. Instead, he climbed into the van beside me and pointed towards the wall.
The sharp, broken teeth of a comb grinned out under the mirror. It was deformed now, but I knew that comb and I reached for it. How did she get this? I said. Where did she get it? What's happened to my sister? Give that to me, I shout. Get off the phone.
Helen turns to look at me, curling a hand against her chest.
It's not yours. Give it back.
She shakes her head and waves me away. I shout her name and she frowns, half stands. I rush over, yank the wire out of the wall and push the coffee table over, sending everything flying onto the carpet.
What's got into you? Helen cries.
She's dropped the phone and stands back against the window seat. I stamp on a glass and kick my alarm clock across the room. I can feel the pulse in my neck beating and there's a pressure building in my head. I close my eyes and shriek.
Mum, stop it. What's happened?
Helen skirts round and puts her hand on my shoulders, but I throw her off and hit out, catching her in the stomach.
Get out, I shout. Get out of my house.
I pace across the room and she backs away quickly, clutching her middle, her mouth trembling.
I can't leave you like this, she says. Mum!
I scream again and push over a chair. And then she's gone. And my alarm clock is broken. The wires exposed, the tiny cogs biting into the carpet. I must have dropped it. I'll have to tell Helen to get me a new one. There's a glass broken, too. Little shards of it scattered over the rug. I find a piece of newspaper in the waste paper bin and gather the bits up, pricking myself several times. The paper begins to darken, drawing the blood into pretty patterns around the margins. I try to piece the shards together, and I feel for a minute the sun on my back and the grass under my knees. And I listen for the pigeon's breathy coo. I expect Ma to come out in a minute and tell me to throw the pieces in the runner bean trench. But of course, she never will. And I twist the paper closed, carrying the broken contents out of the room and up the stairs. Into my room. I shut the door and sit down at my dressing table, and suddenly I can't think what I'm doing here. I was going to the kitchen, wasn't I? I let out a little laugh at myself. How silly to end up in the wrong room. I must be going mad. I walk back down and put the newspaper in the bin. I push it right down as far as I can. I had to be careful to put anything dangerous well out of reach when Tom and Helen were small, because once Helen got into a neighbour's bin and found a cake that had been laced with rat poison. She ate it, and she got Tom to eat it too, though he was the elder and should have known better. I thought they'd both die and was out of my mind with worry, and I had to make them both be sick, pushing a spoon down along their tongues until they gagged and brought it all up. I remember their little hands hitting at me, and then the terrible sound of their retching. But thankfully, they were all right afterwards. I got them to a doctor, and he said there was no damage done. I'd acted quickly enough. Of course I was upset with Tom, but I was angry with Helen. She was always up to mischief, her fingers grubby from mucking about in the garden, digging up worms and making snail farms. Tom was more inclined to lie on the sofa reading car magazines. Irritating when I wanted to vacuum the cushions, but not half so difficult to keep an eye on. I stayed angry at Helen for a long time after the cake incident and laughed when Patrick made jokes, even years later, about not being able to trust anything she'd baked. "You're not trying to poison us, are you?" he'd say, just when she would be proudly presenting her pineapple upside-down cake or her banana bread. "Because you've tried that once before." Young girls don't appreciate that kind of teasing, and there were often tears. But even that was a relief. To think they'd both been in danger like that, and yet here they were, still with us, fussing over teenage romances and getting into trouble at school, and making a mess of my sitting room. Someone's still making a mess of my sitting room. There are things all over the floor, and my coffee table lies on its side. I pick it up and put everything straight, the pens back in their pots, and the notes in neat piles. Someone's unplugged the phone, and I have to stoop awkwardly to get the wire into the wall. I'm shaking as I bend down, and I feel as if something has happened. The skin in my throat is tight, the way it is after you've been crying or shouting. Elizabeth says her son has a habit of shouting, has a terrible temper on him. It makes me sorry for her. Helen gets cross sometimes, but not like that. And Patrick could be brusque, but he wouldn't yell and scream like some husbands. My parents never shouted either, even when I'd done something really naughty, like jump in the river at the pleasure gardens. Frank shouted at me once, though. It was at his house. Suki and I were making a blind for the kitchen. "To keep the mad woman from peering in?" I'd asked. But Suki didn't seem so worried about her at that time, and she told me off again for calling her mad. Said she was a poor thing, said we were lucky not to be in the same way. She'd not been really angry, though, and had put my hair up like the Naffy girls, rolled round an old stocking top, and had even let me wear some of her perfume. I was teaching her to sing "I'll Be Your Sweetheart" while we knelt on the floor carefully cutting the precious material. We'd sewn the little pockets for the dowling rods and were sliding a length of wood into each when the front door crashed open. Frank's face, red beneath the tan, seemed to appear feature by feature as he swayed along the hall towards us. He staggered across the kitchen to the sideboard, knocking over a chair, and I watched in horror as he picked up a knife. But he was only threatening a piece of cheese, lying half-wrapped in paper, which Suki had refused to let me finish off at lunch. "No, Frank," Suki said, getting up and standing in front of me. "I'm saving that."
"What, this again?"
he said, his voice thick and slurred beyond her skirt.
"Can't I have a bit of cheese in my own home? Who are you saving it for?"
"Not for anyone. But what would you know about keeping house, eh? I'm the one who works out the meals. So leave it to me. I am your wife."
"My little wife," he said, letting the knife clatter onto the plate, his voice sharpening for a moment. "My lovely little wifey."
His arm curled round Suki's waist, and she tried to push him away. "Frank, you're standing on the blind fabric," she said. "Get off it." He looked down at his feet for a few seconds, his fair hair flopping over one eye. And he saw me.
Got Maudie here too, have we?
I nodded, shuffling back against the cupboard out of his way.
Making a blind?
He said, looking at his feet again. I held up the length of dowling rod in evidence, and he let go of Suki.
How'd you make a Venetian blind, eh, Maud?
He said, leaning a hand on the counter behind me, and bending very close, his breath like the waft from a pub door. I couldn't guess. I felt too scared to breathe. The arm that had been around Suki's waist flexed above my head.
Poke him in the eyes.
The answer seemed horrible to me, and I shuffled further away, but Frank grinned, his teeth bright and keen in his tanned face.
Hey, Suki,
he said, pushing himself upright.
Venetian? Blind?
It's not a Venetian blind, though, is it? She said, righting the chair. It's a Roman blind.
Still works. Here, Maud. How do you make a Roman blind?
Shut up, Frank, Suki said. You're drunk. She pushed him sideways and finally succeeded in getting him off the fabric.
Drunk? Not a chance.
He shook his head and had to reach a hand towards the counter again. I stared up at him, trying to find the familiar Frank in this vague and fevered version. He noticed my stare and made a face, putting out his tongue and flaring his nostrils. Somehow he looked more like himself, and I laughed, despite my fear. Yes, you are. Go to bed, Suki said.
Only if you come with me.
Oh, Frank, Maud's still here. She doesn't need to hear your filthy talk. Go to bed. Sleep it off. Go on.
Send your bloody little princess home then if she's too good to be in the same room as me.
He made another face, but this time I didn't laugh, and he turned away. Don't start shouting, Frank, Suki said. And don't start that stuff again. Of course you're good enough.
A baby-faced lodger of yours doesn't think so. Always hanging about.
What do you care what Doug thinks of you?
I just don't get what you've got to talk to him about all the time, Frank said. And I know he goes back and bad-mouths me to your parents. Your dad doesn't like me as it is.
Suki sighed and turned to me. Perhaps you should go home, Mops, she said. We'll finish the blind another day.
Yeah, there'll be many more days for finishing off blinds and chatting about what might have been.
I couldn't understand what he was talking about, but I stood up and slipped past him as quick as I could and was almost at the front door when I remembered my coat. I tiptoed back down the hall, but Frank saw me.
What the hell are you still doing here?
He shouted, his face truly contorted now.
Go on, bugger off.
I gave up my coat and ran out of the house, crying until I reached the avenue, where I stopped and wiped the tears away. Then I walked round and round Ashling Crescent until I was calm enough to go home. Chapter 11. Something's happened. I have to get up, get out, get to Suki. I pull on a man's striped shirt and worn, unfamiliar trousers and push things into the pockets. Tissues, a roll of polo mints, a plastic pearl necklace. I wonder if this is a dream. I don't think it is. My bedclothes are all of a tangle, but I can't waste time straightening them, and I start to write a note. But I can't think what to say. The stairs creak as I creep down, and the front door latch clanks noisily in my hand. I pause on the threshold, the muscles of my face taut, but everything is quiet as I set off towards Frank's house. The air outside is cold and fresh and almost sweet. I'm enjoying the feel of it on my tongue, and several minutes of walking go by before I realize I've lost my way.
that this is not the road I thought. The next street is just as strange, and my heart gives a thud in my chest. I'm running out of time. I've got to get somewhere, or to someone. It's urgent. My footsteps echo slightly in the dark, and a fox runs out in front of me. He stops and looks at something on the other side of the road. I stop too. "Hello, fox," I say, but he carries on staring at the opposite pavement. "Fox," I say again, and wave my arms. For a moment it seems really important to get his attention, to have my presence acknowledged. I rummage in my pocket, working a mint out of its packet, and throw it onto the middle of the tarmac. It lands with a ticking bounce at the fox's feet, and he turns, a point of light gleaming from each of his eyes. "Hello, fox!" He runs off, and I walk on. It's these acres of new houses that have me confused. I see now, though how I got here I don't know. I'll never find my way with the roads in a jumble like this. And I'm exhausted. I can't have walked very far, but my legs are heavy and my back's sore. I feel like an old woman. I work another polo from its wrapper and throw this one onto the pavement behind me. It shines white, bright on the dark stones. At least I'll know if I'm going round in circles. A car stops at the end of the road and a man gets out. He wanders towards me, his hands hooked in his belt, his shadow reaching out from the car lights. I begin to back away.
"Where are you going, love?" he says.
He's looking right at me. I can tell, even though his face is just a silhouette. "Home," I call as I turn away, trying to force my legs to go faster. "My mother's waiting up." The man makes a noise, a sort of snort.
"Is she?" he says. "And where's home?"
I don't know. For a second, I don't know.
"But it doesn't matter," I say to myself. "I wouldn't tell him anyway. I wouldn't tell him anyway. And I'll remember in a minute. When I get on the right path, I'll remember."
Soon the man is a good way behind me, still standing by his car. I turn down a street, then another, walking without seeing. On a pavement, I find a polo mint, white and shining in the night. I bend to pick it up and see a big turreted house in the distance. Perhaps I'll recognize something when I reach it. I look into the front garden as I get near, but it's just a dark space.
"Thought home was the other way."
A man leans against a car. The lights glint off his fair hair, and that makes me think of Frank. He's waiting for me. But he should be waiting for Suki.
"What are you doing here?" I say.
"Taking you to the station. Car's waiting."
"Station?" I ask as I get in. There's a mint in my hand, and I pop it into my mouth.
"Are we getting a train?"
The man doesn't answer me, but asks if I want the window up or down.
"Down,"
I say, putting my hand on the inside of the door. I want to leave something behind me, something to tell people I was here. The mint slides against my tongue, and I spit it out as far as I can into the night. The man laughs, and I laugh with him.
"Frank," I say.
"Frank." I walk right into him one day after school. He was standing by Mrs. Winner's hedge, looking towards our house, and he turned round as we collided, putting out his hands.
"Maud," he said, "I was just thinking about paying you lot a visit."
There was a deep dent in the hedge where he'd been leaning into it, and I thought he must have been waiting there for a long time.
"How are your parents?" he asked.
And I opened my mouth, but found I was unable to make any sort of expression. And I wondered if I was imagining him.
"They haven't heard from Suki, then?"
I shook my head and studied his face. I suppose I wanted to see if he looked guilty. But he only looked shabby. There was stubble on his chin, and his hair was a bit longer. His clothes were crumpled and grubby. I was shocked at the change. Where were the perfect creases down the front of his trousers, the starched collars, the shined shoes?
"Can't understand it," he said, leaning over me, his hands on my shoulders. "I mean, if she was going off somewhere, you'd think she'd tell her husband, wouldn't you?"
The words gave me a little flutter of hope. I thought of Suki hiding from Frank. Hiding away somewhere safe. Of course she wouldn't contact anyone if she was hiding.
"But I suppose she might tell her sister, mightn't she?"
Frank looked down at me with his usual smile. Eyebrows raised, a kind of forced gleam in his eyes. It looked wrong on this new scruffy face. His hands pressed down heavily on my shoulders, and I realized he was studying me, too.
"Did she tell you things, Maudie? Things about going away? About me? About anyone else?"
"Nothing, Frank," I said. He dropped his hands and my spine lengthened. My bones rose up. I felt light, too light, as if I might float into the sky and disappear. I wished he'd weigh me down again, but I couldn't think how to ask.
"I miss her," he said. "Miss having her about the place, her bits of things. I don't know what they are. Hair things and bits of material, bottles of scent."
"Evening in Paris?"
"Yeah, that's it."
He stared down at me.
"You remember better than me. Come and have a drink."
I didn't say no, but I must have looked doubtful.
"Oh, come on, Maud," he said. "I thought you weren't a kid anymore. Come and have a drink. Does me good to talk about her, you know."
I knew. Ma and Dad hardly ever talked about her, and I felt as if saying her name at home was forbidden. And here was someone who wanted to remember her properly, with words. I let him lead me to the end of the street and down the hill.
"What else does she have, Maud? What else? You remember?"
"A blue suit," I began, "and lipstick. Victory red. And an old compact that matches her perfume. Silver and navy blue stripe."
"Yeah, that's right. What else?"
"Shoes with buckles down the front. A green scalloped tea dress. Those earrings that look like sweets." Thinking about what Suki wore made me look down at myself, at my brown T-bar shoes and open-knit socks. I didn't notice Frank stopping, and so I walked into him for the second time.
"Hide your school tie, for God's sake. We're here," he said, and went in.
It was a pub, the Five Ways. It had what Dad called a reputation, and I felt a shiver of apprehension. I'd never been in a pub before, and I thought perhaps I shouldn't go in then. And so I dithered, playing with a button that had come off my cardigan. I didn't want to leave the familiarity of the pavement, but I desperately wanted to talk about Suki, and so I dropped the button against the hinge of the cellar door. Somehow, the idea of it waiting out here for me to come back made me feel better, and I pushed the slim half-door open and went in after Frank. It was smoky inside and the air was hot, and I couldn't see Frank at first. I wandered in the direction of the bar and felt a hand on my back.
"Go and sit over there before the landlady sees you," he said,
pushing me towards a table by the door.
"I'll get you a drink."
I felt a stab of nervousness at that, but I went and sat down on a wooden stool. The bar was a few feet away, with dark-clad men's backs lined up in front of it, so I could hardly see the woman serving.
"Back so soon, Frank?" I heard her say. "Must have only been gone a couple of hours."
I leant an elbow on the table, It was slick with spilt beer and wetness seeped through my cardigan. I was taking it off when the door opened, and a thin, sweating man walked in.
"Hello, girlie," he said, hanging over the table.
A drop of his sweat hit my chest, bleeding into my school shirt, and I thought of Ma's tears on the silk of Suki's nightdress. I watched the circle of moisture spread flatly, turning the fabric transparent, and trying not to breathe so that it wouldn't stick to the skin underneath. The man said something, but I couldn't take it in, only aware of his breath against the top of my head. I was starting to sweat myself with fear, and I couldn't bear the idea of mine mingling with this man's.
"Is that a yes, then?"
he said, and I turned my face away. Frank had started to come towards me, and he winked as he walked. I felt odd, as if I had somehow taken Suki's place. Here I was, in a pub with her husband, being bought a drink. And where was she? Had we switched places? Was Suki at home with my parents, playing patience and listening to the wireless? Frank put the drinks down on the table. He looked at the sweating man, moving very slowly.
"Can I do anything for you?"
he asked. The man raised two moist palms as he backed away, and I gratefully picked up the nearest glass. I could see Frank was having beer, and I hoped he hadn't brought the same for me.
"Ginger ale," he said. "That all right?"
I nodded and breathed a sigh of relief. The noise in the pub grew as more people piled through the door.
"Hello, Frank," someone said as he brushed past. "You back down south again?"
"That's right," Frank said, keeping his eyes on me.
I stared down at my bare knees, rubbing my nails over the reddish patches.
"You look just like her, you know," Frank said, putting a hand to my chin.
I smiled. I wasn't convinced, but I smiled all the same. And Frank leant towards me for a moment, closing his eyes at me like a cat.
"How are things at your place, then? Just the same, are they?"
He rested a hand round his glass, and a bead of moisture dripped slowly onto his thumbnail. It seemed to linger a moment on the cuticle before dropping like a tear, and I was distracted as I answered. "Not really. Ma and Dad are very worried."
"Watch her, Frank!"
a fast-looking woman shouted across the pub.
"When you gonna give me them nylons you promised me?"
Frank turned slightly to nod at her before letting his eyes drift back to me.
"And Douglas?" he asked. "He's still there, is he?"
"Where else would he be?"
"Well, I don't know. He might have gone and grown up. Might have stopped hanging around your mum waiting for handouts."
"He's our lodger. He doesn't get handouts."
"Your lodger, yeah. That's what you think."
He took a long drink of his beer, and someone pushed past just as he was lowering his elbow, jolting him so that beer ran down over his sleeve.
"Fucking watch it," he said.
I waited for him to say sorry for the swearing, but he didn't. Instead, he gulped down the rest of his drink and stood up.
"I'll get another round," he said.
And when he came back, he had a glass of whiskey or brandy or something, too. I bit my lip as he put it on the table.
"You do look just like her," he said. "You got that same disapproving expression."
He raised his glass in a mock toast, and I pushed my own away.
"I've been in jail for 2 weeks."
"I know," Douglas said. I wondered if I could ask about the coupon fraud, or if it would make him angry.
"Douglas would. He would know all about that." "It's the Mrs. Frank," said a man in his shirt sleeves, rolling his cap in his hands. "Bit young for you, isn't she?"
Frank swore at him.
"Come on, Frank, get a sense of humour. Tell you what, Ron, I'll get one when you start being funny."
Ron let his cap unfurl with a flourish.
"Fine, fine," he said. "Only being friendly. Go and be friendly somewhere else. You got a right one here, love.
Ron said, raising his eyebrows.
I hope you can handle him.
I frowned after him as he walked away. People seem to think I'm Suki, I said.
No, they don't.
They do. You said I look like her. Everyone else seems to think so, too.
You don't look that much like her, Mordy. You're still a kid. You look like a kid.
I was hurt. Why'd you bring me to a pub, then?
I wanted a drink, that's why. And because I wanted to say something to you.
I finished my ginger ale and twisted sideways on the stool.
Hey, hey,
he said, reaching over to pull me round again.
We're having a conversation here. Look at me.
What is it you want to say, Frank? I said, annoyed and wanting to go home. Ma and Dad will be expecting me.
My God, you bloody sound like her as well. You'll be telling me I've had too much to drink next.
You probably have had too much.
Yeah, well, so would you.
He looked down at the floor and sat like that for so long that I thought he'd forgotten me. I pulled my beer-damp cardigan on.
And so your parents don't want anything to do with me, he said suddenly. They think I killed her or something.
I didn't know what to say, and I stared at him, thinking that his hair and even his stubble looked angelically blonde in the light from the bar.
Your dad wrote me a letter, he said to his beer glass. Want to see what it says?
I didn't answer, but he fished a crumpled envelope from his jacket pocket and threw it into my lap. It was the note I'd seen Dad push through the door when we'd been to Frank's all those months ago.
I know this is your doing. You won't get away with it.
I was shocked. I'd thought Dad was leaving a message for Suki.
Well, he never liked me. Wasn't much I could do about that. Especially with that little rat-faced idiot whispering in his ear all the time.
He looked up at me with narrowed eyes and a curled lip.
He told me to keep away.
Who did?
Your fucking lodger.
I left after that, telling him it was the third time he'd used bad language, and wincing at how much I sounded like Dad. I found the button from my cardigan on the way out, still nestled in the cellar door's groove, and I pressed it hard into my palm as I walked home.
"Fucking let go of me, you fuck!"
a woman shouts, twisting her body round. A policeman holds on to her arm and signs a book on the counter.
Fucking pigs!
She shouts again. I try to block her slurred voice from my ears and slowly drop the last two polo mints onto the floor. When they're gone, I start on the plastic pearls, breaking them from their string and sending them tiptoeing across the room. I wonder if this hallway's been used for a film. It's very familiar. There's a big glass lantern hanging from the ceiling and a shiny black and white floor. I concentrate on these things rather than look at the people.
I don't want to think about the people.
The shouting woman is led away through a door, but I can still hear her. And a man on the bench next to me starts to sing.
Que sera, sera.
Whatever will be, will be. We're going to Wembley.
Que sera, sera.
His frayed football shirt is wet and smells of beer. He swings his feet, and one catches a bead, sending it skittling back towards me. I pick it up and curl it into my hand before sliding along the bench away from him.
That's all we need, the policeman behind the counter says. The next bloody Pavarotti.
He goes to open the outside door, and another policeman brings someone in, dripping blood. His nose is a mess, and his eyes are rolling around in his head.
We're going to need a doctor, the policeman holding him says.
He has blonde hair, which catches the light, and makes me think of Frank. Her perfume was evening in Paris, I say.
and she had earrings that looked like sweets.
No one seems to hear.
Que sera, sera.
The singing man sings, swaying over towards me. His beer smell is mixed with vomit, and he's sweating.
I'm going to file a complaint,
the bleeding man says through the blood. He swings his fist, but doesn't manage to hit anything. I shrink further into the corner. I don't know what I'm doing here. The lights are very bright, and I'm squinting against them. Eventually, I shut my eyes altogether. Perhaps this is some kind of nightmare, and I'll wake up in a minute. The noise gets louder, and a policeman shouts over the top.
No more cells, Dave. Give 'em a caution and chuck 'em out.
They're scuffling, swearing. Someone comes close and breathes over me. Then the noise recedes a little. I keep my head down and my eyes screwed tight. I sit like that as long as my muscles will stand it. And then, Mum, I hear through the noise. Mum, it's me. Open your eyes. Helen is leaning over me. She strokes my arm and manages to block out everything else in the room. I put a hand to her face, but I can't speak. I feel I might cry in relief.
Let's get you home, she says, pulling me up from the bench.
There's a polo mint on the floor, and I reach for it as she guides me through the crowd of football supporters, stepping in a patch of blood on the way out. She keeps an arm round me as we walk, and I keep an eye on the ground. When we stop to cross the road, I pick an earring up from where it lies on the pavement. A striped earring, like Suki had.
Mum, put that down, Helen says.
Her voice sounds funny.
Where did you get it? Don't collect old rubbish.
Come on. She walks ahead and I drop the earring. It bounces off my body as it falls and lands in a puddle. I thought it was mine, I say, forgetting why.
At least now I know where the piles of junk have been coming from, Helen says.
The light glitters off her cheek as if she's been sweating.
What were you thinking, she asks, coming out at this time?
I'm worried about you.
Perhaps we should see Dr. Harris again.
I can't answer her, even if I knew the answer, even if I could remember the question. But until we drive off, I can still look at the earring in the puddle. There was a time when it could have meant something, when I would have taken it home with me. I took masses of things home with me when I still had hope of finding Suki. Bits of paper, nail files, hair clips, an earring. A striped earring, like a humbug, which made me want to put it in my mouth and taste it when I found it lying on the bandstand steps. I couldn't bear to walk past something that might be Suki's and not pick it up. I'd fill my pockets and later pack the things into my matchbox chest or arrange them on my windowsill. Sometimes I'd examine the finds, writing down what they were and whether Suki ever had anything like it. Once or twice Douglas came in asking what I'd found. He'd look at the bits, touching them lightly, and he never said anything. But I felt he was searching for some significance, creating scenarios, coming up with stories for each object, ways they might point to finding Suki or finding out what had happened to her. I started to believe I would really discover something important, and so I looked even more carefully for evidence. Mostly I looked after school. I didn't want to go home anyway, to sit by the range and carefully not talk about my sister for fear of upsetting Ma or starting a row with Dad. I didn't want to go home and change into the clothes Suki had made. So I wandered about the streets in my uniform, scouring gutters and hedges. I often walked down Suki's road and traced the journey she would have made from her house to ours, or walked the way she would have gone to the shops, or the station. It was the station hotel where they'd found the suitcase, and if she'd left town, I thought it would probably have been on the train. Sometimes I leant on the platform railings watching the trains coming in, imagining Suki stepping from a carriage in new London clothes. "I just went to do a bit of shopping," she would say. "What's all this fuss?" I spent hours staring at our matching combs, holding them up to the light to see how the wings seemed to flutter, and I wondered at myself. She'd been frightened by those birds in the glass dome, so why had I given her such a precise reminder? I wished more than anything to speak to her about that, to tell her I hadn't meant any harm. I thought if there was a single chance of finding her, it was worth trawling the streets. I usually arrived home pinched with cold and too tired to eat. It was soon after that I got ill. I'd stopped sleeping long ago, it seemed, and instead just lay in bed trying to think where Suki might be. It's not that I deliberately stayed awake, but my mind wouldn't shut off, and I went over and over that last meal, trying to remember everything she'd said. Things about Frank, things about Douglas. I was tired all the time, and I couldn't concentrate at school. I struggled to pour the tea straight in the evenings. "For goodness sake," Ma shouted one morning, throwing a skirt down at her feet. "More bits of rubbish." She'd been turning out my pockets to do the laundry. "Maud, you have to stop bringing this stuff home with you." She waved an old coaty lipstick lid around in her hand. "You're going to send me mad. Do you hear? What's it all for? What are you planning to do with it?" I felt limp and exhausted next to her show of energy. "I thought they might have been Suki's," I said. Chapter 12. "Have you moved?" "No," I say. "I've been here for ages." I'm sitting in a sitting thing, for sitting on, facing a computer screen with red writing running along it. "Please make sure your GP has your new address." Every now and then there is a high-pitched beep and a name flashes across the screen. "Mrs. May Davison. Mr. Gregory Foote. Miss Laura Haywood." Helen squeezes my wrist when I start to read them out loud. She is sucking on one of those strong, mentholy lozenges you get for sore throats, so I suppose we must be here for her. There's a child bashing a plastic brick against a table of toys in the corner. He looks like a Ken doll whose head's been squeezed. Helen tells me to keep my voice down and holds out a cardboard box of sweets. I take one and pop it in my mouth, wincing at the way the sweetness of it makes my jaw swell, and watching as the boy's mother reaches to take his brick away. She isn't quick enough, and he's off, scampering past other patients, who pull in their legs to make room, but can't avoid being bumped by the little body. He runs, staggering like a slapstick comedian, into the far wall, and then throws the brick back towards his mother with sudden violence. A man tuts, rolling his eyes and smiling at me. I smile back, and then, getting the sweet between my teeth, spit it out in the direction of the brick. Helen makes a squawking noise and starts to apologize, but I don't hear what she says, as the screaming laughter of the boy drowns out her words. He twists about in a sort of joyous dance, making his way almost gracefully now between the rows of people. And he comes to a rest against my knees, landing lightly, like a bird, no longer laughing, but opening his hands to show me what he's been carrying about with him. Another plastic brick, like the one he was bashing. A little metal car missing a wheel, a chubby doll's arm, and several other things. I can't think what they are. He balances them all on my lap, and I pick them up one by one, turning them in my hands and describing them to him.
You see here, they've made semicircles in the plastic for fingernails, I say.
He stares at me solemnly, not giving any sign of having understood, and so I put down the doll's arm and balance a squat splayed thing on my palm. I can't work out what it is. I can't think past its peculiar shape. I say nothing for several seconds.
Fog, the boy says finally.
Fog, I repeat, supposing that must be the word. He presses a little tab at the back, and the fog jumps, not very sharply, as my hand is too soft a surface, but enough to bring the toy to life for a second. The boy makes a gurgling sound and presses the tab again. This time the fog flips over, leaping with its own show of joy, and lands on the seat next to me. Serious again, the boy cradles it for a moment, and then pushes the fog through an opening in my handbag. There's a beep, and I look up to see my name in lights. I stand, and the toys fall from my lap. The boy shrieks with laughter, throwing the car and the brick into the air. I hear them clatter to the floor a second time, but I don't take my eyes off the computer screen. Sorry again, Helen says to someone, picking up her coat and leading the way. Come on, Mum. In a small room, the doctor is staring at his own computer screen.
Hello, Mrs. Horsham. How's your thumb? Won't be a moment. Sit down.
Helen puts me in the chair next to his desk. I can't remember why we're here.
You sit next to the doctor, I say to Helen, getting up.
No, Mum. We're here for you. I sit down again and ask for one of her sweets.
You're eating one, I say, when she says no. Why can't I?
The doctor swivels round to face us. He says he's going to ask me some questions, and then he asks me what day it is today. I look at Helen. She looks back, but doesn't help. He asks me the date, the season, the year. He asks if I know which country this is, which town, which street. Some questions I know the answers to, some I make a guess at. He seems amazed when I get it right, but it's not very difficult, this quiz. It reminds me of the one they had at the day centre. Elizabeth and I went there once to see what it was like. They asked things like, can you think of a colour beginning with B? Elizabeth was outraged. What sort of a quiz is that for adults, she said. A lot of bloody stupid questions, I say.
There's no need to get agitated, Mrs. Horsham, the doctor says,
adjusting his neckcloth thing. Not a scarf, not a cravat.
I have to assess you, you know.
No, I didn't know.
Yes. As I explained, that's what I'm doing now. So, what's this building?
I look around at the walls. There are lots of notices about washing hands and sterilizing things. Washing hands can prevent diarrhea, MRSA, norovirus, I read. The doctor turns and looks at the poster. He makes a closed-lipped smile at Helen.
Do you know what floor we're on?
I think for a moment. Did we come upstairs? A lift? I look at the window, but the blind is drawn down. What makes a Roman blind?
Poke him in the eyes, I say.
No one laughs. Well, I never liked that joke either. There is some throat clearing from the doctor and from Helen. She pats my leg, and the doctor pats his desk, as if it were my leg.
I'm going to name three items, he says, and I want you to repeat them back to me, okay? Train, pineapple, hammer.
Hammer, I say. Hammer. What were the other ones? Hammer. My notes are in my handbag and I have to reach under the chair. I start to shuffle through them, but I can't find the answer. I find a little plastic frog instead.
It's best if you don't use memory aids, the doctor says.
That's all right. It's no good anyway. I can't find anything helpful. There is a note here about Elizabeth, though. It says she's missing. It says, where is she? That's the real question. Why isn't the doctor asking that?
Now, I'd like you to count backwards from 100 by sevens. Do you understand?
I stare at him.
Mrs. Horsham. So it would be 100, 93, 86, and so on. Do you see?
I see, Doctor, but I don't think I could have done that even at your age.
Please try.
He's already looking down at his papers and making notes. There's something else I have to remember. All this nonsense is interfering. 100, I say. 93. 92. 91. I know I've gone wrong, but I can't think where.
Thank you. Can you repeat back to me the three items I mentioned a moment ago?
Three items, I repeat, not quite sure what the words mean because I'm scrabbling in my brain for the other thing, the important thing.
Never mind. What do we call this?
He points at the telephone. A phone, I say. That's it. Elizabeth hasn't phoned. It's been a long time. I don't know how long.
I'm sorry about that, the doctor says. What about this?
He holds something up. He doesn't even say Elizabeth's name. The thing is thin, made of wood. He waggles it between his fingers, the way we used to in school, a trick to make it look as though it's floppy. I can't think what it's called, though. Not a pen. A tray, I say. That's not right, but I can't find the word. A tray. A tray!
Okay, not to worry.
He puts the thing down and picks up a piece of paper.
Take this in your right hand, he says. Fold it in half and put it on the floor.
I reach out to take the paper. I look at it and look at the doctor. I check both sides of the paper. There's nothing on it. No writing. I let it lie on my lap. He leans over and takes it off me, putting it back on a pile. Then he holds up a card with the words, "Close your eyes," written on it. I'm beginning to think he's bonkers, and I'm glad Helen is here. The doctor puts the card down and hands me some more paper and a thing. A thin thing, made of wood.
Now, I wonder if you could write a sentence for me, please. It can say anything at all, but it has to be a full sentence.
My friend Elizabeth is missing, I write. Helen sighs next to me. Pencil, I say, when I give it back to him.
Yes. Great. Actually, you need to keep that, because I'd like you to draw something. I'd like you to draw a clock face. Can you do that?
He hands me a board to rest on. I start to draw, but my hand shakes slightly, and I don't make a very good job of it. Somehow, the lines go the wrong way. Like when you try to draw something while looking in a mirror. I forget what the drawing is supposed to be, but the shaky circles remind me of a frog, and so I turn it into that, adding big round eyes and a jaunty smile, and when the pencil slips, wild hair and a beard. I put the drawing on his